This is a podcast from Minute Media.
Hey y'all, this is Josiah Gray, and this is Half Street High Heat. Hope you enjoy today's episode.
What's up, everyone? You're joining us for a very special episode of Half Street High Heat. You guys can follow the show on Twitter at @HalfSTHighHeat. You can also find us on YouTube under the same name. Why is it such a special episode? Because we're joined by the one and only Jesse Dougherty of the Washington Post. You guys can give him a follow on Twitter if you do not yet at @Dougherty_Jesse. And you can find them in print and online at the Washington Post in the sports section. Jesse, how you doing, man? Thanks for joining us.
Good, guys. Appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. It's always good to have you on, talk some things Nats. You know, we got a little bit of news because there's not much going on with the lockout. That's probably never going to end, but we'll get there in a little bit. The biggest news for the Nationals this offseason was they signed Christian Vaquero out of the Dominican Republic in the international signings. He is a consensus top two international prospect. This was a pretty big get for the Nats, and they paid around $4.5 million. That's a club record for the international bonus. And what makes him so special? Like, why are the Nats so confident that giving him that club record signing bonus was the right thing to do?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think part of it is that we won't know for a while, right? And that's kind of just the reality of these things. Like, I think he gets the five tool label a lot, which is sort of a buzzword for any top prospect. And he's a switch hitter. Seems like he can maybe stick in center field, giving his speed, but maybe go to the corners because he's more of a power guy. But to me, like, I feel like there's two sort of distinct ways you can go about the international signing period. And in the last 2 years, we've seen the Nationals spend a lot of money at the top. Two periods ago now, it was Armando Cruz. This year it was Christian Vaquero. And for me, like, that obviously signifies that they have a lot of confidence in that one player because they're using a bulk of their bonus pool money on him. Whereas a team like the Orioles is sort of on the opposite end of the spectrum, where they signed 24 prospects compared to the Nationals 10. And given the high variance of international prospects and teenagers and all these sort of factors, they're going to sort of, it's like they're flipping more coins, right? Like, if we consider all this a coin flip, they're going to flip a bunch more and see if they can hit on some of these guys. Whereas the Nationals are hoping like their coin is like weighted, so to speak. Like, it's more, has a better chance of going heads or tails because they have like maybe more data or more belief that this guy, in this case, Vaquero, last year Cruz, is going to click. So I think like you've seen now sort of a trend in like kind of going for broke. I mean, it's obviously not the first time the Nationals have done this. Yasiel Puna, Juan Soto, Victor Robles, Luis Garcia, like there's a long list. Andrew Lara too, to some extent. So I do think like it just shows a distinct strategy here that is a bit different from other organizations. And you obviously trust those scouts down there to make that big swing rather than like taking a bunch of little cuts.
Yeah. And we definitely want to ask you about the scouts and player development, but I wanted to talk about another international signing that, you know, got the buzz of Nat's Twitter, and technically not a signing yet, but it is a verbal commitment. Elian Soto, obviously that last name is going to turn everyone's heads around baseball, not just, you know, amongst Nat's fans. Committed to the Mets and then kind of decommitted, like he's, you know, a college recruit or something, and then verbally committed with the Nats. Can't sign till next year, but I mean, who knows, there might be a draft next year as opposed to just international signing. Can you provide any insight on kind of what happened there? I assume Juan Soto played a part in, you know, wanting his brother within the organization.
Yeah. I mean, I from what I know, Juan definitely was pushing for it. And I think the Nationals are generally inclined to listen when you're
playing.
Or once something happened. I do think, like, not to disparage what anyone was doing around that time, I thought maybe the news cycle for it was a little bit premature, just because, like, while I'm sure, like, Elian has a verbal agreement with the Nats, as all these very fine reporters have put out there, like, as you mentioned, like, there's a lot of caveats here, right? Like, he now has as much of a deal with the Nats as he did with the Mets before he flipped his commitment, so to speak. And also there is a chance with the new CBA that the entire international free agency is moved to a draft and this is all sort of moot. So I think like it's all moving in the direction that if things stay the same, if all things are equal, if nothing changes, then Elian will, you know, be with the Nationals. It's probably a bit nihilistic to be like, but will the world even be the same, right, in a year or whatever? But like, you know, I do think like it was sort of an odd story born of like, you know, the time of year, maybe the fact that there's a lockout, there's not a lot to report on and talk about. But yeah, I mean, from all I know and all, like I said, everyone that's reported on this has said too that he does have sort of a handshake agreement with the Nationals and as of now is trending toward joining the organization, which is cool. I mean, it's fun, right? Like if nothing else, covering Soto's younger brother, who I'm sure will want to shake that label at some point, but will always be followed by it, is a fun thing for me as a writer and fans to follow too. So it's definitely a cool thing.
And not tampering at all by the Nats or the Mets with Soto's younger brother. One of the things that the Nationals are also doing is they have 14 new roles and 20 new staff members within their player development program.
Yeah.
We've seen, you know, some issues with the Nats player development, not to point names, but there's been some guys that maybe losing the roster spots in center field and third base have not lived up to their potential. Most notably, what all went into the Nationals finally deciding that they're going to boost up all of these new positions in their minor leagues with player development? And what can we expect from all of these hires?
I just pictured that like a game of Clue or something. It's like Victor Robles in center field with the glove, you know, when you're I think, so to me, like, obviously it's sort of like these international prospects, right? Like we're in the mode now in Nationals world of always talking about the future. And for these international, for these player development hires, I think it's like, you know, we'll check back in 5 years, right? And see what the effect is of this new reshaping. I think for most, you know, the most important thing is that it's a foundation that wasn't there. And I think the Nationals had the basic positions. In some cases, they didn't even have that going last year without a catching coordinator. No video staffers full time. So they were, whatever they did have was basic. And now they've added some positions that are a bit more cutting edge that are probably still a full cycle or two behind what most of the league is doing, but at least positions them now to build off of that, right? So like a perfect example for me is they hired this guy, David Longley, who's going to be their player development technology and strategy director. And that is a position that most progressive organizations or all progressive organizations and most organizations across baseball have already employed. And in the more progressive organizations, David Longley is the head of a team of 5 or 6, you know, whatever, 7, 8, you know, so for some organizations, 10 people that, that do these things, right? That work with data, that work with technology, that, you know, work on special projects or pitch development or pitch shape, all these things. So the Nationals now are starting with one. And while that's great, and because they started with zero and one's more than zero, it's only a beginning. Whereas now maybe in future off seasons, when more additions happen, when they look at themselves end of the year and say, where do we need to improve? Maybe someone like David Longley, should he still be in the position, gets 2 people under him, right? And then maybe a nutritionist, they hired Emily Cayley from the New York Mets. Like maybe she gets an assistant nutritionist and so on and so forth. So I think the fact that the Nationals are laying down the foundation is a good thing while also recognizing that they're really delayed in doing so. But you have to start somewhere. So the fact that they were the smallest player development staff in the league last year, that they lacked a lot of these basic positions, that they've also added sort of more traditional roles to help out with the workload, whether it's an extra athletic trainer, whether it's a mental skills coach, whether it's a development coach at each affiliate, which is sort of like a pseudo bench coach, maybe it's a bit more specialized. Those things are really good too. But I think, you know, the way I sort of look at it and the way I parse it out is that now the base is there where the base wasn't there before. And it actually just gives a better jumping off point than existed. And that's, I don't want to maybe make it more than that, but that is also a big thing, if that all makes sense. Like it's a little bit of word salad. But.
Yeah, I mean, it's important that they're finally laying the base. Like you said, they had no full-time video equipment recorders or whichever the position name was, but that's kind of wild to me. And one of the other things that the Nats have been kind of lacking in, which the rest of the league is starting to fully dive into, is analytics. Are any of these moves going to help bolster the Nats analytical program, especially since we're seeing so much of the league be driven by analytics and a lot of these quote unquote smart franchises are basically driven by analytics? Will these moves help lay that foundation so the Nats analytical program can improve?
Yeah, I think Longley will. I think, you know, you hear technology, maybe you think Rep Soto video, all those things, TrackMan, but I think his a part of his role will also be player reports, dealing with data, you know, using some of the cutting edge trends to influence sort of how players are taught from a fundamental level. That's, I think he's going to do that. I know Sam Nairn, who's a new pitching coordinator, who was the AA pitching coordinator last year. People have told me that he's really good with data, and he is a holdover. He's an internal sort of hire or move, so to speak. But I do think he maybe doesn't fit quite the mold that we're used to with the Nationals, in the sense that he has a good blend of sort of old school baseball. I say that sort of with an eye roll, because it's just kind of just taken on a life of its own, and old school baseball, but also sort of is good with the sort of new technology and ways in which pitching is being taught. Joe Dillon's the new hitting coordinator. He was on the Nats staff in 2019 and before with Kevin Long. He goes to the Phillies last year and is the hitting coach, you know, for two seasons. And like, I know they, you know, for example, like they have an analytics person in their clubhouse. So he's been maybe exposed to that more than he would have been with the Nationals, who didn't necessarily have that hands-on person actually directly in the clubhouse day to day. So small things like that. And again, like it's not where it needs to be. It's not, you know, it's not all the way there. It's not like the teams you've mentioned sort of as the smart orgs that, you know, whether it's the Yankees or the Dodgers or the Rays or the Astros. And I think it's like, you know, it's, you don't want to typecast them all as being, you know, the only ones that are doing things well either, because there are good minor league systems in the league that are not necessarily, you know, tabbed as that sort of smart brainy organization. But like, if you think of that list, like they're putting out prospects all the time, and they're putting together major trade packages for great players. And like, it's hard to argue with the results there. And then you look at their staff list, and it's, you know, like you said, it's, you know, it's director of data, it's director of pitching projects, it's special performance coordinator, it's biomechanics. And to some degree, or maybe are those superfluous titles, or do you need 10 of them rather than, you know, five, or five rather than three? Like, you could argue that there's too many cooks in the kitchen, but you should have some cooks there, right? So the Nationals are, again, starting out that way and inching into it, but there's a lot of work to be done still. And whether it becomes actually organizational philosophy too is a whole other thing, which means that the sort of holdover regime, people still in charge, need to enable these people in order to actually like put their expertise and their viewpoints to work.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And another area that Nats definitely need to hit on, especially the current state of the team post, you know, this past trade deadline, is the MLB draft. They have some, you know, seemingly promising prospects, but others going the opposite direction. I want to talk about Seth Romero. Obviously, last week he got charged in Texas with a DWI. This is not kind of his first character issue, I guess. He had a spotty track record at Houston, was suspended, and then I believe in spring training one year he got sent home. Don't remember the exact story, but obviously this one is the largest offense, so to speak, of the bunch. I know there's a lockout, so the Nats can only do so much. I don't even know if they can really do anything right now, but what is his future like with the organization as a whole? Because it's not necessarily an isolated incident.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know. I don't know for certain. It's worth noting that like team officials are not allowed to comment on players specifically during the lockout, and have sort of stuck to that too, as in terms of side conversations as well. I mean, a lot of people have been pretty mum, not right, just on Seth Romero, but on multiple players. And that's at least been my experience as a reporter during this. And I will say, like, as far as like how many strikes do you get, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's hard to say. We don't know all the details yet. I'm personally still waiting on the arrest report from Brazoria County, Texas. But in the past, Seth's transgressions have been team, you know, violations, violation of rules, team conduct, you know, all that sort. I think when you start breaking the law, it adds a whole layer to things. So that's, I mean, maybe read between the lines of what I'm saying is like, I think it could be more consequential for him than maybe in the past, where slap on the wrist, suspensions, whatever it may be, rather than, you know, being DFA'd or released. And, you know, I mean, I think it's worth saying, and I don't know all the details myself either, but just, you know, as a general sort of overarching point, like, I hope if, you know, there is some, you know, if he's acting out in a certain way or using substances in a way that he shouldn't be, like, I hope there's also help for him somewhere, whether it's with the Nationals or elsewhere, that, you know, he gets that and can sort of get himself on track, because obviously he was a player with high potential. He still is. And, you know, it's, you don't want to see anyone not have the resources or not feel like they can sort of maximize their potential in anything. But again, like, I think when it comes to breaking the law versus just team rules, we're talking about two different things, and that could affect how the Nationals deal with it for sure.
Yeah.
And switching gears a little bit, we saw before the lockout, well, the impending lockout at the time, the Nationals were pretty quiet. They did sign Cesar Hernandez in the final days before the lockout. What was the Nats' approach going into the lockout? Were they taking more of a let's see what happens with the collective bargaining and everything during the lockout? And what can we expect for them when the lockout finally ends, if the lockout ever officially ends?
Yeah, right. I think it will be pretty similar to what we saw pre-lockout. And that's probably disappointing for people to hear, but and I understand that because obviously people invest emotionally and financially in this team. They want to see it win, try, push for a division title like it does in most seasons. But the reality is Nationals sort of, when they started the rebuild in July, I don't think they saw a path to winning this year. If they did, they wouldn't have traded Trey Turner. And now that they are not sort of acting as if that's the goal, so to speak, I think the goal is net more to look toward the future, develop the system, see what you have in some guys who are either on the cusp of the major leagues or have been shaky. We mentioned earlier in passing Robles and Kiboom, Garcia, sort of some of the younger guys, Tanner Rainey, Kyle Finnegan. Maybe that's a wide age range, but the point is like there's maybe some fringy players that either are going to be part of the next core or not, and this is a good year to test them. And it's hard to go into a 162 game season as a test or as a practice period. And I certainly feel that the nature of professional athletes, Nationals will be trying to win every game in a sort of literal sense. But in terms of team building, I don't think we'll see what we usually do, which is if there's a hole or there's an uncertainty on the roster, Mike Rizzo and his staff have been known to fill it, right? There hasn't been a lot of off seasons where, they needed a left fielder, they needed a starting pitcher, they needed two relievers, they needed a catcher and a backup, and then they did it. They went out and got everything, or checked every box. And I think last offseason was a great example of that, where every hole was filled by late January. It was Avila and Lester and Brad Hand and Kyle Schwarber, and it was a lot of one-year deals, but it filled every box that was needed to be checked rather than saving that money or allocating it to one big player. It was more of a, I don't want to call it paint by numbers because that makes it sound like it's, really rudimentary, but it's more of a basic team building philosophy rather than trying to maybe take a big swing on like a marginal player or try and sort of rehabilitate someone who maybe has struggled and you see some potential in, which we see some organizations do really well. So it's, I don't think that's going to be the case this offseason. I think we saw Hernandez for the infield. Aceyes Escobar will be back either as a starter or a reserve. I could see an addition in the bullpen or the rotation, especially if it's someone that they could see either on a 1 year, 2 year contract and be flippable at the next deadline to get more prospects. But I think one thing Mike Rizzo said that really resonated with me was that they don't want to start adding major pieces until they know what they have here. Right. So like, for example, the counterpoint would obviously be like, maybe it's not much anyway, so you should just add what you can now and maximize the market and whatever is out there. But like, if Luis Garcia comes out this year and is, a really good player and proves to be everyday major league, second baseman or shortstop, which maybe seems a bit more precarious given the defensive issues last year, but let's say, middle infielder, then when you're thinking about free agency, like you don't want to give a 5-year deal to a middle infielder, you can give that money to another starting pitcher or reliever or a corner outfielder. Same goes for Victor Robles too, right? Like he has a chance to prove himself this year. He flops again. Now you're thinking, okay, center field is a position of need when establishing our next core. And then the same goes for Kay Cavalli coming up. How many pitchers do you need? Does he fit the mold? Is Josiah Gray, is he an ace? There's a lot of different things. Can Riley Adams be your backup catcher? I think this year is really fascinating from that standpoint, is that it will influence the next steps of the rebuild and who actually is sort of a target in the next free agent class when the Nationals do decide to build. It's just a matter of how long that will take. And all wrapped up in all of that, I know I'm rambling here, is like, is it responsible to have maybe arguably the best hitter in baseball on your roster and not trying to win every season? You could argue no. So if you want to make that argument, I would listen to it and I would believe some of it. Right. But I think those are sort of all the factors at play.
Yeah. I'll make that argument. Don't worry.
Okay. Who's going to raise their hand first?
I texted Nick Boo when you said the Nats are probably going to take it pretty quiet the rest of the offseason.
Yeah, I know. It's tough. It's tough.
Yeah. I like to see him get like one more guy in there as a little building block, but I also don't blame them in taking it slow. But you started touching on the infield guys. They got Hernandez, Escobar, Garcia, Kiboom. Those are four guys for three positions. who's going to be the odd man out? Are they going to do a bunch of just rotating, or is Escobar going to step back and be more of a utility off the bench kind of guy?
Yeah, I'm going to my least favorite words of a report, the reporter can say, I'm about to say what I would do. Because it feels like armchair managing, and who cares what I would do, right? It's more a matter of what the Nationals will do. But because we haven't been able to talk to, the front office a ton or the coaches a ton, which we usually would, about the plans for them, you have to kind of, project a bit or do some sort of educated guessing. And so what I would do, again, hate those words, but what I would do is play Keegan at third, Garcia at shortstop, and Sir Hernandez at second most days, and have Escobar sort of a roving extra man. The reason for that is, one, I just think Hernandez is just more talented than Escobar day to day. I think he had a really good stretch, a solid stretch, after coming over to the Nationals in July. But I think, he's at his age, and the fact that he was out of baseball or Major League Baseball for a few years, that's sort of the writing on the wall that he's in a stage of his career that I don't think he's an everyday player. And to me, I would test Garcia at shortstop. He had a lot of errors in Rochester last year. Probably profiles best as a second baseman, but you may as well know if you have a shortstop there. Because let's say it comes out this year and he's a really good spring training and he, he's really solid there in the field. That's an important building block. Whether he's a future trade chip for a great, another great player, or he is the guy for you at that position, whether it might, again, enable you to spend money elsewhere, a really big bat at third base or at second base or whatever it may be in the corner outfield, all those things. So I would at least see shortstop being such a marquee position if you have it. Hernandez, his natural position is second base. It's where he plays best. And Carter, I think similarly, is going to be out of chances soon and has really struggled at the major league level for the most part. But you may as well see one more time when the stakes are low, if you have something there, whether he can stick at third. So I think Escobar being the one that sort of gives you the least upside, both on a competitive standpoint day to day and also for your future in the rebuild, I don't really see much of a point of playing him, four or five times a week when you could play those two younger guys, test them, and have Hernandez, who just is all around more effective player at this point, at second. That would be hard.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, if they're not going to go crazy or make any major splashes the rest of free agency once the lockout ends, then it makes sense to just kind of, you might as well see what you have in the young guy. So it makes sense to make Garcia kind of the centerpiece of the infield. But I want to go to the other centerpiece, the most proven of the infield guys, and that's obviously Josh Bell. Been some chatter recently. I don't know where it's at. I know I saw it on the MLB Trade Rumors article. I don't know who or where it came from. What is Josh Bell's future in DC looking like? Because halfway through, maybe two-thirds of the way through last year, everyone's like, extension, extend Josh Bell. I know I'm definitely in that camp. I'm sure Ryan's in that camp as well. But now, if they're not making moves and Josh Bell's on an expiring deal, are they going to extend him, or is he a candidate to be traded at the deadline if, say, Riley Adams emerges as a capable first baseman?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good question. Josh Bell to me is super interesting because he kind of feels like a bellwether for the whole rebuild in a way. If you trade him this July, it's going to be longer than we thought. And if they don't and discuss extension with him, it's going to maybe be shorter than we thought. So I think he occupies that position given the fact that he only has one more year of team control. He occupies this spot in his career and that I think could give us a really strong indication of what the next steps are going to look like. And that to me makes him immensely interesting in this coming season. So I was probably in the camp that you're in. I mean, I think you need to field a good baseball team no matter what. This is more theoretical and philosophical than maybe you're asking, but I think it's every team's duty to field at least a competent baseball team as a baseline. You don't have to be competing for a championship every year. It doesn't make sense every season for every team to go all in. I mean, I wish it did. It should. And that's a whole other discussion. But I think signing Josh Bell for 3 years, to have him be your first baseman through the rebuild. And maybe the rebuild accelerates and you get lucky on some people and a prospect accelerates faster than you thought. And you hit on a reliever in free agency. And all of a sudden you're last year's Red Sox team that was probably ahead of schedule and really talented and had a really good run. Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense to keep Josh Bell around and have him in the middle of the lineup with Juan Soto. But if they're thinking of this as like a 5-year process, then maybe in June, it makes sense, you know, if June, July, he's hot, like to flip him for, you know, 2 to 3 prospects or a really big name or something. And I think I'm not answering your question because I don't quite know how that's going to look, but I can see both ways. And what I can say is I think he's sort of the key to understanding the time frame, because frankly, Nationals have no reason to tell us the time frame, because then they're going to be held to it, right?
Right.
Like publicly putting out like, we're going to win by 2024. Like, okay, now you have to, or we're not going to till 2027. Okay, now no one's in the ballpark. Like, no one's going to come to games. So like, I think like, we're going to have to read their actions to know what the time frame looks like. And to me, he's like the best, that he's like the best person to do that with. So I'm really interested in like how that looks for him.
Yeah, it makes sense. Again, in my perspective, or my desire is to extend him just because he's, I think it's safe to say he's become kind of a fan favorite, even though he's not like the most vocal guy or whatever, at least to us as the fans. But, you know, he's just quickly become a fan favorite, and, you know, good baseball players are, you know, we would like to see them stick around. But obviously, I would be remiss if I didn't at least ask. I'm sure there's not really much to you know, report on, but what are your feelings on a possible Soto extension? I mean, I feel like he's going to free agency, but again, I have to ask.
No, for sure. I mean, I wish both for my newspaper I work for and for you guys that I have more to say about it. we're still a long ways out. We have more Ellie on Soto news than Juan Soto news, which is
right.
A weird place to be in. Yeah, I mean, like that's my read too. Like, I think what I the sense I get, and this is based on reporting and conversations, but also more of just like reading the past behavior of both parties and agent included, like, is there a number that gets Juan Soto to sign before he goes free agency? Yes, I think there always is. Are the learners going to put it on a check? No, I don't think so. So I don't know where that leaves it. I mean, it leaves it that, like, I think extension's very, you know, unlikely, but maybe, you know, maybe the payroll savings during year 1, 2 of the rebuild will maybe make that hypothetical number appear. Like, I don't mean that to get anybody's hopes up. That's not based on sort of any like actual knowledge, but it's more so like, maybe that's how the numbers sway. But other than that, no, I don't have any updates. And I do appreciate the question. I think it's going to be one we're going to be talking about for a while. Let's plan to do this 1 year from today and we can talk about it. see if there's anything new.
I don't think we'll have anything new next year.
Right. Maybe two years from today.
Oh boy.
So last question we have for you today. It's a big one. If you had $10 to put down on who's going to win the Super Bowl, who are you saying is going to win the Super Bowl as of today before the divisional round playoffs start?
Oh, man. A sport I don't follow. Packers are good, right?
Yeah,
Packers. Packers, I would say. I think. I have a friend, I have a buddy who covers them, and he speaks very highly of their chances this year. So,
all right. So I'm gonna go put the futures on them. If they're wrong, we're gonna have a little conversation with your buddy.
I'll Venmo you. That's how it works. You know where to find me. I can't escape. But no, guys, I appreciate you having me on. I want to make sure I say I really thought you guys did a great job with the Josiah Gray interview earlier. Listen to it, and I learned a lot. So that was cool. It's cool to listen to.
Well,
yeah, appreciate that.
Yeah, we really appreciate the feedback. That means a lot. We're gonna clip that and just play that on every single episode. For now. Yeah,
if you hear that as our new intro, like, just don't be surprised.
Don't be
like
surprised.
The new, like, you are listening,
right?
Yeah, right.
Like,
yeah.
Exactly. The voice.
It was authentic. I wasn't reading a script.
Exactly.
We didn't Venmo him beforehand to set up. Jesse, wanted to thank you for coming on. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you, and there was some pretty good stuff to talk about in the middle of.
Yeah, it wasn't all depressing.
Yeah, you know,
some of it was depressing, but not all of it.
all the infighting that's going on between the league and the players. Once again, you guys can give Jesse a follow on Twitter at @Doherty_Jesse, and head on over to WashingtonPost.com to keep up with all of Jesse's latest pieces, as well as everything DC Sports. Jesse, thanks so much, man. Have a great rest of your day.
Appreciate it, guys. Thank you.
Yep.
There's a new breeze blowing off the banks of the Potomac. A new team's mowing down the ranks of their opponents. The Nationals are smashing balls, so that's the commentator who has to call his past the wall to see you later. Let's go Nats. We've got a game to play. We're gonna win today. Let's go Nats. We're gonna score for score. We're gonna win for sure. So call your local congressman. We need another monument. The Nats are rolling on the wind. We're holding D.C. Let's go Nats. By the early light of dawn, well, you can see they're running scared, cause the kinds of bombs we're launching aren't bursting in the air. Tell the Library of Congress that they might not want to look, cause we're putting curly W's in every book. Let's go Nats. We've got a game to play. We're gonna win today. Let's go. We're gonna win for sure. You better.